Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're in depth this hour with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. She'll be in studio, but first to the climate cast.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
This is the time of the week when we talk about the science of climate change with NPR meteorologist Paul Hudner. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, to have you here. Carrie. Good to see you as
been
always.
Been a while since we've been in the same studio together, but happy you're here.
Yep.
Both of us spotted this New York Times story about, and here's the phrase that jumped out at me from Justin Gillis's piece, sunny day flooding.
Yes.
Right? What struck you about the article before we bring Justin in?
It's an excellent piece, first of all, but this is, Carrie, is really sort of where the climate change rubber meets the road on the coast. This is the intersection of the physical science of climate change and sort of the human geography of our coastlines. That combination of a warmer planet drives the rising seas through thermal expansion and glacial melt. We've talked about that a lot. Places like Greenland melting and pumping more water into the oceans. And that, of course, causes inundation of low-lying areas, neighborhoods, cities, and that's happening now at an increasing rate. In fact, an alarmingly increasing rate and expensive rate. That's the key thing here. There are real dollar costs with this when we start talking about cities like Norfolk and Charleston and Miami Beach.
Which Justin profiled in the piece.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And there are big costs here that are eventually going to work their way around to all of us. So this is a why anyone should care about what's happening on the coast kind of story.
Justin Gillis is a reporter. He wrote the story for the New York Times. It was headlined, "Flooding of Coast Caused by Global Warming Has Already Begun." Justin, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
Let's say that this, when we talk about this kind of flooding that you wrote about in the piece, it's not just about heavy rain events. I mean, we've seen that in Minnesota, but I think we've also seen some of this, what you call sunny day flooding as well. Describe what we're really talking about.
Well, on the coast, the two things really interact. What we have is, of course, a rising sea, and we should be clear with everybody. We're only sort of inches into this in places where the land is sinking, we're maybe a little over a foot into sea level rise. We're ultimately going to get many, many feet. And so we're already seeing a kind of an increase in this, what people call either sunny day flooding or blue sky flooding, where, it's not always sunny, but, you know, on a perfectly clear day with no storm, you can have water in your streets. I mean, I saw that with my own eyes. my own eyes in Charleston. I saw it in Norfolk, and so the heavy rains, which are also, we know, there's a trend in these really heavy precipitation events that's related to human induced climate change. That interacts with the sea level, because as the ocean rises, our sort of drainage gets less efficient, if you will. I mean, we actually have water backing up into the storm drains and so forth. So when you get a heavy rain on top of tides, the water can't drain. And so if you're living in Norfolk, you know, people there well know that, you know, they sometimes have to completely replan their route to work because there's water in the streets. I mean, we've got marsh grasses growing in people's yards. It's real. It's happening.
I just want to make sure that we make the connection here, and I think you've done that, between greenhouse gas emissions, sea level rise, and then this kind of flooding. So as you say, sea level rising and infrastructure in these cities, for now on the coast, that cannot handle that incoming higher water. Have I simplified it or made it more complicated? How would you describe it?
That's right. The ocean is rising slowly. That seems to be accelerating through time. Of course, it accelerates, you know, gradually by decades. We're at a rate globally of about a foot a century now, but the scientists are worried that's going to speed up quite a bit in the coming decades. And so as the ocean rises, you basically it's a change in how often we see high water at the coast. I think a lot of people imagine that, you know, you're fine, and then one day the ocean comes in and covers you over. That's not how it's going to work. It's really a change. You know, the sea level, because of tides and all that, is varying up and down through time anyway. As we push the baseline level higher, what's going to happen is a change in how often we see this tidal flooding. And, you know, that's going to cause problems and probably ultimately drive people away from the coast a long time before we see sort of permanent inundation, if you will. Am I answering your question?
No, you did. Yeah, okay. Paul?
Justin, when it comes to climate change on this show, I often say follow the money, right? And your piece did a good job of that. And one of the photos there of the market in Charleston struck me because I was standing there last January, and when I saw that picture, it immediately brought it home for me. So in the piece, you highlight Charleston spending about $200 million, Miami Beach $400 million. Norfolk, Virginia has a wish list of $1.2 billion. That translates to about $5,000 per person in Norfolk. And New York City spending $20 billion in coastal resilience. This is just the very beginning and the sort of the tip of the iceberg here. So the first question is, who pays? And I guess the follow-up is, how big do these numbers get in the next 50 years or so?
Well, and of course, we have, on the second part of your question, we have no real idea. Mm-hmm. I think you can safely assume we're talking about trillions if we want to defend, you know, many trillions if we want to defend the entire American coastline. I mean, realistically, by the way, more than 30 of our states touch the ocean. A lot of people don't realize that.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah, we're essentially a maritime country, as much or more than any in the world, really, of any big country. So, you know, it's ultimately will be in the trillions to defend even part of the coastline. And you know, we won't be able to defend it all. And so the question becomes, okay, who wins and who loses? That, I assume, is going to be some fairly ugly politics, you have to think. But listen, it's really worse than this. Right now, we the taxpayers, are spending many, many, many billions of dollars to subsidize coastal development. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're an economic conservative and looking in this situation, even if you doubt climate science, you really ought to be asking yourself, how much sense does it make to be using the taxpayers' money to sort of pay people to put themselves in harm's way? And, you know, we've all seen this unfold with the storms in recent years. When the crunch comes, people are going to be looking at the taxpayers to be made whole, we know. And so, you know, one of the kind of immediate steps on which there ought to be sort of political consensus is, let's stop spending money in stupid ways right now and start spending it in ways that make us more resilient. We're not doing that.
Justin Gillis is with us for the Climate Cast. He's a New York Times reporter, and we're talking to him about a really excellent piece about coastal flooding on days when there isn't some big heavy rain event and there isn't a big flood, seeing cities and municipalities inundated with water on blue sky days, as they call it. So we've tweeted out the piece so you can get a look at it yourself. You know, I was just thinking, Paul, when you were asking Justin about this, that the dilemma here is, and we've seen in Minnesota how state government and city governments react when there's a big flood event, right? It's all hands on deck. It's emergency funding. I think Justin is also alluding to the fact that this is the ongoing thing that needs funding that isn't very sexy.
Yeah.
Right? Hey, we need to shore up the sewer system because, you know, we're going to have problems with this.
And it's really two things. It's that slow creep of sea level that is causing the sort of sunny day floods. But then what happens is you have that rising base state of the ocean, and then you superimpose the next catastrophe, the next Katrina, the next Sandy on top of that higher base state of sea level, then you have a catastrophe. So it comes in slow, sort of creeping progress, and then bam, it hits with a vengeance like we had with Katrina or Sandy. And so it's both things. It's happening slowly, and there are going to be catastrophes along the way. You know, Carrie, while you were gone, I interviewed Philip Stoddard, the mayor of South Miami, a couple of weeks ago. And Justin, the quote that ends your piece really caught my eye. He says, ultimately, we give up and leave. That's how the story ends.
Wow.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
It is. I have to say, he might be the most intelligent public official I've ever interviewed on this subject.
Yeah,
certainly
agreed.
The most intelligent, most intelligent local mayor. And, you know, we sat at his kitchen table in South Miami and talked for quite a long time. And it was sort of harrowing, really, to talk to somebody who's already, you know, where he is in his thinking. You know, he rightly points out, you know, it is not time to sort of throw up our hands and start abandoning the coast. There's a whole lot we can do with intelligent public policy to sort of slow this down and minimize the pain for people. And so far, we're not doing it. As I said, we're doing the opposite. We're spending money still by the billions in some fairly stupid ways. So our politics are, you know, you might say they're gradually moving toward confronting this problem, but we're certainly not there yet.
Justin, Paul and I have really admired the Times' coverage and your leadership on climate issues. Paul spotted the open climate editor position that the Times has at the moment. Are you beefing up your team reporting on this?
We are indeed trying to do that. The paper has recognized that, you know, this is in a lot of ways the story of our time. It's a very hard story to tell, you know, because it just moves so slowly. It's, you know, it's not that different, you know, this year from last year, right? And so, but we are trying to beef up our team, and the posting for a new editor, I mean, it's not that complicated. The gentleman who was doing it, Adam Bryant, a fabulous editor, has moved to another position within the paper, and we're basically saying to all comers, you know, if you think you're the right person to do this, please come talk to us. So I'm hopeful that we are moving in the right direction in beefing up our coverage, and we're even talking about adding reporting staff to the subject.
Good.
We want to go more global in our coverage of this issue. So we're trying.
Yeah, I saw, Justin, in the post it says that climate change is, quote, the most important story in the world. Interesting to see the New York Times take that position. What kind of a response are you getting? From the post, it's a pretty rare skill set. Somebody visionary, entrepreneurial, steeped in climate science, a journalist, perhaps a broadcaster. What kind of a response are you getting to the post?
I think Paul's ready to apply, no, Justin. So
I've got a good gig here. But
I have to plead a bit of ignorance on that. Of course, I'm a lowly reporter, and so they're not applying to me, these folks. They're applying to, you know, much more senior editors at the paper. I do know some of the names of people that have expressed interest, and I cannot, of course, share them, but I think it's safe to say, I mean, this is a very high profile editing job in the world of journalism, so I think it's safe to say they will have some applicants from which to choose.
We're looking forward to what comes next with the reporting out of the team, Justin. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Justin Gillis is a New York Times reporter. He's part of the team that covers climate at the Times, and we were talking about his latest story headlined, Flooding of Coast Caused by Global Warming Has Already Begun. Hey, what else, Paul, have you been watching this week?
Well, quick follow on that, too. I'm really encouraged to see that posting from the Times. There are still very few well-focused national news outlets on climate change coverage, which is a bit of a surprise.
Right.
I think they nailed it by saying this is the most important story in the world. I don't think the rest of journalism management gets that just yet.
I think it's part of the reason is what Justin said. The statistics don't change dramatically, you know, week to week, month to month, right? It's a slow-moving, incredibly important story. And a lot of media just isn't cut out to the slow-moving part.
I get that. And then we'll have these periodic catastrophes that come along, and I think that's what's ultimately going to change it. Quickly, Louisiana floods, those devastating floods.
Baton Rouge.
New study, attribution study coming out directly linking those to climate change from NOAA, Princeton, Climate Central, saying it was about 40 to perhaps 50% more likely that flood occurred because of human-induced climate change. Uh-huh. So the climate change fingerprints get a little clearer with each one of these extreme weather events that comes along, Carrie.
Paul, I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thanks, my pleasure.
That's the ClimateCast for the week.